Hallito and welcome to Native Chalk Talk, a podcast by Natives for all. Here we're keeping our Native ancestors' stories and history alive, while also sharing with you our Native culture, traditions, and more. I'm Rachel Youngman, a Choctaw originally from Anadarko, Oklahoma. I hope you'll enjoy this journey with me as we learn from our Native American guests. And I hope you'll do me a favor. Feel free to like and share these episodes. I so appreciate it. Yakuki.
Did you know that Native Choctaw supports missing, murdered Indigenous women, Chutta? Simply go to cafepress.com/Native Choctaw Shop and you can find hoodies, sweatshirts, t-shirts, cups, all kinds of things. And a portion of proceeds goes to help the organization as well as the families and the victims. God bless. Two boys walked west off the main road and walked up the hill, reminiscing about their day out exploring. As they walked up the long, dusty Oklahoma road toward home, the summer sun beat down on their long, dark hair, their shirts drenched in sweat. As grasshoppers bounced about the tall, dead grass and the sound of cicadas buzzed in the cedar trees, they figured it was probably time to start supper. On and on, they argued about who would do the cooking, which then suddenly brought another thought to mind. They were reminded that there would be no mother to come home to, nor to make their favorite meals. Their mother was gone, passed away suddenly a few months back. And so their worlds had changed in an instant. Dad left to go live in another town, and their other siblings had moved away. They were alone, just the two of them. The excitement of the day soon subsided, bringing their feet to a slow pace as the chirping of the cicadas soon gave way to the singing of the whippoorwills. Their hearts sank. They both fell quiet as the thoughts of Mama and the time she would stop to listen to the whippoorwills in the trees and their ongoing tunes simultaneously came to their minds at the same moment. They remembered the way she'd welcomed the boys into the house with a cold glass of lemonade after they had been playing outside in the heat, and how she'd pray in Kiowa over them at night. They had heard the almost annoying, monotonous song of the whippoorwills many times before, but for some reason, the tune they sang today stuck in their hearts, which sunk into a puddle of pain. Loneliness had once again decided to pay a visit. They would go on to raise each other and to survive. They had no choice, but it didn't make things easier. Perhaps the songs of the whippoorwills triggered sorrow, but perhaps it would also remind them of better times when Mama was alive and when their family was together in the house nestled between the cedar trees on the hill at the top of the long, dusty road. Today, my guest's story is one that will tug at your heart, but will also inspire you. And you'll hear ancestral stories like none you've heard before, as well as about some Kiowa legends of old. Meet Blas Presidio, a member of the Kiowa tribe of Oklahoma. Blas served our country as a U.S. Marine Corps veteran from 1967 to 1970 and served in the reserves from 1985 through 1991. He then worked for the Indian Health Services for 27 years and later worked for the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes and the Apache tribe of Oklahoma. Blas joined the Kiowa Black Leggings Warrior Society in 1990. And has been a leader since 1997 when he was appointed to the position of whip man, and he serves as commander of all color guard activities. He has been a member of multiple clubs and teams, including a member of state championship baseball team, played men's fast pitch softball, and was a long distance runner, Native American craftsman, bows, arrows, lances, etc., golfer, and photographer. One of the highlights of his life was when a set of his bows and arrows were purchased and displayed in the Gilcrease Museum of Tulsa, Oklahoma. Blas was appointed in 2019 as chaplain of VFW Post 1035, Talent Gassaway, Anadarko, and secretary of the Kiowa, Comanche, and Apache Veterans Association that was formed in 2019. Blas gained political experience while serving on the election board of the Kiowa tribe from 2003 to 2004, and he was appointed on February 5th, 2023, to serve on the Kiowa Gaming Commission, where he was elected as vice chairman. Blas, welcome to Native Chalk Talk. It's kind of ironic how we met. your niece Mary and my sister Skylar are friends. And Skylar kept telling me about the ancestral stories that Mary knew from you and the cool things that you had done in your lifetime. And Skylar said, you just have to interview him. And then I found out that you grew up probably 5 or 10 minutes from the house where I grew up in Hog Creek outside of Anadarko. And your great grandparents were also from Hog Creek.
Yes.
So I felt like we were meant to meet. Anyway, shout out to Mary and to Skylar for connecting us. All right, so Bloss, you are Kiowa, as we mentioned, and Mexican, and the story around your heritage is fascinating, so we'll get to that in just a moment. But for those of you who may not be familiar with the Kiowa, they are one of the Plains tribes, and why don't you tell us a bit about your tribe, the Kiowa?
Yes, the Kiowas in our language, there's very few fluent Kiowa speakers. I'd say a half a dozen. So it's disappearing, but there's been efforts made by individuals and our tribe to continue our language and our language. So we're called different words, but the main word is Goigu, and that means like principal people. Goigu. Mm-hmm.
Goigu.
And like myself, I'm a Kiowa man, so I would say, Goi can he ado. I'm a Kiowa man. Now we have a written Kiowa language, it's called an orthography, and it was developed by Parker McKenzie and along with a linguist that he worked with from the late 1900s. Like the teens.
Okay.
He worked with a fellow named Harrington. Then he worked with another lady back in, I think, in the 80s, and Laurel Watkins. From his interest in preserving a Kiowa language, he developed an orthography. Saw something recently in our Kiowa Indian News. We have a convert to Kiowa orthography, and that's one of our teachers of our Kiowa language, Julia Noel. We call it her Kiowa name is Akima. And so she has become a proponent for the Kiowa orthography to preserve our language. She learned that what we call diacritical markings determine length of the sound, the nasalization, the length up, down. It's very important. And you can't get that with a phonetical spelling. And so some of our elders that are fluent in Kiowa, and they saw the way that orthography was written, probably weren't given an opportunity to learn it or attend, you know, classes. It's not just speaking our language, but to preserve it for song. It's important that our people, young and old, as best they can to pronounce our words correctly. Properly. And getting back to our Kiowa history, since we didn't have a written history, so we have to rely on oral history. And some of what I know, oral history, we go back to what they call the Yellowstone region up there in Wyoming. We come out onto the plains, and at that time we didn't have horses. We had dogs to transport our Kiowa odalisques, our belongings. Huh. And then so we come out onto the plains and acquired horses. We occupied areas up there in the north, the Black Hills, and then among others. And then we were gradually forced south. Larger tribes, the Sioux and the Cheyenne Arapahoes, they were forced out from the Great Lakes region onto the plains. And they in turn forced us to come down south. And so gradually we worked our way down this way to the southern Great Plains through Nebraska, Colorado, Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, parts of New Mexico. So this was our range, the southern plains. By the late 1700s and the early 1800s, we were down here. Encountered the tribes that were already here for hundreds of years, like the Wichitas and the Caddos, and then the Comanches were already down here. They were from up north. I believe they were part of the Shoshones. we were supposed to be linked to the Pueblos. And then there was some oral history about some of the places that link us to the Pueblos and our journey from the Pueblo area, New Mexico, up north through Colorado and then up Idaho.
And so how did the Kiowa, as they started migrating further south into the Southern Plains region, how did they work or not work with the Kiowa and Apache?
The Kiowa Apaches, who prefer to be called Apaches in the present day, they were with us from our earliest memories. They were with us when we were up north. When we came south, they were always with us. They were, how you call it, a satellite tribe.
And did they become warring tribes, or did they play nice in the sandbox together?
They were our allies. So they were even included as part of our, like in our Sundance, the bands of the Kiowas got together. They were included. They had a certain place in our camp circle.
And today there's KCA, which is Kiowa, Comanche, Apache. And because at some point a lot of them were placed in Fort Sill, it seems, and I may be wrong, but it seems like that ally friendship is still very strong today.
Yes.
A lot of the communities are still around each other, and I love to see that.
I'll give you a little bit of history on that. When we came to this region, the Comanches were down here. How long they were here, I don't know. Maybe the 1600s, fought with the Spanish that had control over Mexico. When we came down here, we fought. Then we made peace with them in the late 1700s.
Hmm.
And the area that I'm talking about is like Texas, north panhandle of Texas, and on into the central of Texas. And so we made peace, and then by the late 1700s, early 1800s, some of our main camps were down like in the Wichita Mountains.
Okay.
And one of our camps was located in 1833 when the Osages came, attacked our undefended village on the western end of the Wichita Mountains. They call it the Massacre of Cutthroat Gap, where they killed about roughly 150, 160 men, women, and children. When our, I'm not really sure what's that, what's factual. Most of our men were out hunting buffalo or went out on a war party.
Mm-hmm.
There's a long history in between that time, and we signed a peace treaty in 1867, called the Treaty of Medicine Lodge, Medicine Lodge, Kansas. And by this time, the bands of the Cheyenne Arapahoes, they divided between the northern groups of Cheyenne Arapahoes and there's a southern group of Cheyenne Arapahoes. Those are the tribes that were in this region.
Mm-hmm.
Kiowas, Comanches, Apaches, Cheyenne Arapahoes. There were tribes that were here for hundreds of years, who knows how many years. They were here when the Coronado came through in the 1500s, and that was the Wichita tribe. Of course, and, the neighboring tribes in southeast Oklahoma, the Caddos were here,
mm-hmm.
northeast Texas. So we signed the Treaty of Medicine Lodge, and the government assigned us a reservation in southwest Oklahoma. And that's how we came to be in southwest Oklahoma. We signed that treaty. Fort Sill was established in Lawton, Oklahoma. From 1867 to early 1875, our people lived primarily on the reservation, all of our tribes. With some exceptions, some of our people still went out on the plains and hunted buffalo, and also went on their horse stealing
a little horse thievery
and revenge raids. There were several campaigns mounted against us, both cavalry and infantry, in 1868, I believe it was, and Custer was down this area, 1868, mm-hmm. 69. The Buffalo soldiers were stationed at Fort Sill,
mm-hmm.
10th Cavalry. The last campaign was what they call a Red River War, 1874. Some of the people that settled around where I come from, my community, Stecker, Redstone, Hog Creek, and right over there toward Gawky Creek, I guess you could say, Buzzard Creek. We're descendants from that last band that came in
okay.
in early 1875. And of course, in Comanches, Quanah Parker, his band was, I believe, the last to come in. One of our, well, a winter camp was at Palo Duro Canyon. I think it was late 1874. And then they destroyed our camps, and along with all our provisions, food, and then they captured horses. I don't know how many horses they killed. They killed them.
Wow.
So, yeah, so that kind of ended our time out there. Then at some point in time, our agency was located at Fort Sill, or near Fort Sill, and then it was moved to Anadarko. There was already an agency, an Indian agency in Anadarko.
Okay.
And that was the agency for the tribes that had been removed from Texas. It already given them a reservation a little bit north of the Washita River, across, you know, from where Anadarko is up in that area.
Well, thanks for sharing that. And I'm a big fan of the Kiowas. I even took one lesson in Kiowa, trying to understand the language a little more. And I find it very difficult compared to even my own Choctaw language. And so kudos to the Kiowa and their brilliant language. So we're going to start talking now about your ancestral stories, and then we'll hear your own inspiring background, a story that has been born out of heartache and abandonment, but brought you to the success you found today in both your professional and personal life. So your mom was Kiowa and your dad was from Mexico. What were their names?
My father's name was Blas Presidio. Pronunciation is Preciado.
Preciado.
It means precious or anointed one, Spanish. And so my dad was a Mexican Indian and he was Spanish. My mother was Anna Abua, Kiowa, but she was also Mexican Indian because my great grandfather captured the Kiowas. I think it was around 1847.
Interesting.
And his name was Bico. In all probability, his last name was Viejo, which means old man in Spanish. When he was captured, the Kiowas corrupted his name to Bico.
Really? Okay.
He also had a Kiowa name. His Kiowa name, Kiowa, is Pawsokgudu. Pawsokgudu means a red thunder.
Oh,
and so
beautiful.
That's his name. So he was captured. He became a warrior, and he was also a member of the Kiowa Black League.
Was he?
Yes,
so he followed in his footsteps.
Yes, and it's that's documented too. He's James Mooney, ethnologist for the Bureau of American Ethnology, came in and wrote a lot about the Kiowa people and also the Eastern Cherokees. Give him a lot of credit for preserving our Kiowa history. With his documentation of our Kiowa calendars, we know that my great-grandfather, Biko, was wounded, shot in the stomach in 1872. In Kansas, in a fight with some settlers up there. He went with like a headman or war chief of one of our warrior societies, Tainetaide, and that means top chief or bird on top. That's interesting too, because Biko's son, who's my grandpa, Sam Auburn, he was married to Nancy, my grandmother. Nancy has three half sisters, and of all things, their dad was Thane Tide.
Oh, really?
And not only
really?
That, Thane Tide was a prisoner of war at Fort Marion from 1875 to 1878. Hmm. And my great grandfather, Biko, was also a POW at Fort Marion.
Wow. Oh, what a coincidence.
Yes, yes. Yeah, they were, so they were in prison together.
Hey, how's it going? Wow.
Yeah.
Coincidence? I think not.
My Aunt Fanny was the one that told us legend stories. My great-grandfather, Biko, he was shot. And she didn't say how he was shot, but she said he was shot outside of Fort.
So the Kiowas had changed the name Viejo to Biko. It kind of transformed it. he was depicted in a Kiowa calendar in 1872. And you had shared some information with me about James Mooney, who wrote a collection of history, and I was able to find Biko through that. And Mooney writes, the Septon calendar, which was the annual Kiowa calendar, has a picture of a man wounded in the chest with a tree above his head to show that the event occurred in summer. This has reference to a skirmish with the whites, which a Mexican captive named Biko or Viejo, and he was shot, but afterwards recovered. He was one of those selected for the confinement in Florida a few years later and is still living and with the tribe. The fight took place in the course of a raid into Kansas by a small party of Kiowa under
Benitai,
Bird Chief, which was undertaken against the protests of the other chiefs who desired to be at peace with the Americans. Near Medicine Lodge Creek, not far from the Kansas line, they were joined by some of the Osage and soon afterwards met a party of white men in wagons, whom they thought were surveyors. A skirmish ensued, resulting in the wounding of the captive and one of the Osage. So very interesting, and that all goes back to what you just told me, that whole story. And I found it so fascinating when I was reading about it recently.
Yeah, my great-grandfather, Biko, and my great-grandmother, so old. Grass carrier. So, and then this is documented. There was an old mission, and I'm sure that mission was at the same place where our current Hope Creek church is located. They lived down the stream, I don't know, 300 or 400 yards. And that's where my great grandfather, Biko, and great grandmother, that's where they lived, and along with my grandpa Sam and grandpa George Washington Dankoff.
So there was the story you had told me once about how the Kiowa fled from the reservation to the Wichita Mountains in the wintertime. And your grandpa, he actually got lost, right? In that whole transition?
Yes. That's some of the oral history that was that I recall. My mother is Kiowa, and her brothers and sisters, with one exception, they all lived within 1 mile, 2 miles of each other at Stecker. We were all, we're part of that community, part of our family. So I was around Kiowa speakers when I was a little boy.
Mm-hmm.
My mother also told us a story about when my grandfather, Sam, he was born like in 1861. The Kiowas fled. The cavalry were chasing them. In my mind, I envisioned them being on the north side of the Wichita Mountains.
Right.
In that area, that range, and going west. It was cold. They fled, and some of them were walking. And my grandfather got separated from his parents, and he got lost. Someone else found him, and they took him. But that's a true story.
Oh, my gosh. How old do you think your grandpa was at the time?
This probably happened in 1869. He was probably about 8 years old, 7 or 8 years old.
He was just a little guy.
Because I think what happened was that when Custer came in this area, well, maybe one of the bands fled to the out there to Texas Panhandle. It was in the wintertime. And how in my, I was little, but I could envision where they were, like on the north side of the Wichita Mountains and going west. And my mother must have, I guess she probably told us where it was and remember that.
To have that story passed down is amazing. And I've spent a lot of time in the Wichita Mountains. My dad worked at Fort Sill after he left Riverside Indian School. And we spent a lot of time camping in the mountains, of course, in the primitive area where there was no water or electricity. But we absolutely loved it out there. And it can get very cold out there. The wind blows through there, that Oklahoma wind, and it can get pretty cold. So he must have been so scared. We talked about the Kiowa capturing Mexican people, and this was a common practice, apparently. The Kiowa and the Kiowa Apache were allies with the Comanche, as you mentioned earlier. And during the Comanche-Mexico Wars, during 1821 to 1870, they all conducted raids throughout Mexico. In those raids, they'd steal cattle and horses by the hundreds of thousands, which was fueled by the demand in the United States for horses and cattle. According to TexasBeyondHistory.net, one such narrative is that of Jose Andres Martinez, who told his story to Reverend J.J. Methen, a Methodist missionary working with the Kiowa in the 1890s. Andres was 10 years old when he was taken captive by the Mescalero Apache in 1866 while he was tending to cows on his family's land near Las Vegas, New Mexico. A few months later, he was exchanged to the Kiowa for a mule, two buffalo robes, and a red blanket. Andres was reared by a Kiowa family in Oklahoma, traveling with them into Texas on numerous occasions. In the 1880s, as an adult, he tried to assimilate into his birth family, but he returned to the Kiowa in 1889 because, in his words, his interests were all identified with the Kiowas, and he had learned to love them. Like other Kiowa captives, he remained among them until his death in the 1930s. According to Andre's story, when he was welcomed into the Kiowa, he traveled with them to a place near the confluence of the Pecos and Rio Grande. It is difficult to discern exactly where he was, but he described the region as an area of very little water. And finding sufficient water, he, the women, and other youth were told to stay in their camp while the older, experienced Kiowa traveled south to steal horses. 10 days later, some returned with horses, and the long three-month march back to the Kiowa camp on the Ouachita River began. When they arrived in the camp on the Ouachita, Andres was surprised by the large number of teepees present. So I'm assuming this would be very similar to your ancestral stories. And speaking of, since we've talked about their history, let's talk about your own story.
Well, first of all, my father was married twice to both Kiowas. And of course, my dad married my mother. And then Sister Karen was the oldest. She's still living. Charles, he has a Biko's name, call him Biko. We all have Kiowa names now. Karen gave her her name is Bidion. Bidion means it's coming down the stream. And Charles, my Biko. Next was Rose, my sister Rose, she's still living. And her Kiowa name is Tokama, means kissing girl. Then
I love that.
Then my I like to kiss everything that she could.
Oh, that's so cute.
So I didn't call her Pokemon. And then my sister Teresa, who's passed away, her Kiowa name is Maud all day. That means the act of reaching up, because there's a story behind that. Reaching up with your arms to be held.
Oh, so
and
cute.
That's her name, Maud all day.
I love that.
Then, of course, there's my little younger brother. His name is Tony. Tony Allen, Presidio, he's still living. His Kiowa name was Pulain on Hogan. It means rabbit jumped over him. Rabbit was rabbit jumped over him.
Wow.
And then my name is Montahawkey. Montahawkey. It means prominent nose. Hook nose man. That's my Kiowa name.
So interesting.
Childhood name. Mother's married three times. Her first husband was named Satokini, Lil Satokini. They had one daughter, and that was my oldest sister, Wanda. Wanda May.
So now at just 6 years old, you were out in the fields working one day. Tell us about that.
Growing up in the country, down at Stecker in the late 1940s, I was born in 1947. At that time, Oklahoma, our Indian people, we'd just come out of the Dust Bowl days, the 1930s. But it was a really terrible time economically.
Right.
Not just economically, but environmentally. It was hot, extreme periods of drought that devastated our economy, our agriculture in Western Oklahoma in particular, in Texas. Parts of Kansas. And so we were just coming out of that. Then not too long after that, I was born and I saw not just myself, but others, we saw the evidence of the sand that had blown and accumulated on our land because of poor farming practices, the erosion of our soil,
right.
The gullies and on farmland. And I know this for a fact because from a young boy, a little boy, I worked out in the fields My dad farmed my mother's land, and then we worked for farmers picking cotton, so we were familiar with the land. And then later on, hauled hay for my uncle and others. At an early age, 5, 6 years old, I remember picking cotton for a farmer that leased the property next door, saving my money. I remember I had a gunny sack. I saved my pennies, and I remember how I saved. My dad smoked Bull Durham. Those of you who don't know what Bull Durham is, Bull Durham was a brand of tobacco, and they sold it in a little white pouch and had a little drawstring to tie at the top, keep your tobacco from falling out.
Mm-hmm.
And then roll your own cigarettes. You know? So you have to buy your papers.
Yeah.
And then just roll your own. Back then, you know, transportation was a problem because not everybody had cars. So we had our main transportation in the early 1950s was with what we call wagon and team.
Hmm.
My dad had workhorses. And we had a wagon that we would go to the nearest store. And nearest big town was Apache, and that was about 5 miles away. But
mm-hmm.
We didn't go there with, on a wagon and team. We just went to Stecker. And back then, you had to, things that you wanted, you went down to your local grocery store,
yeah.
And they had catalogs.
Yeah.
And there's a post office down there, and you ordered things out of that catalog. So what I ordered a cork gun with the money I saved. I don't recall how much it bought. It might have been about $1.30 or something like that.
What does a young boy use his money for after picking cotton?
Yeah,
a cork gun.
Yeah.
And it's crazy to me that from my generation to yours, your family was driving a wagon still. It wasn't that long ago that people in Oklahoma were still occasionally driving a wagon. Also at 6 years old, something had also happened to you. And I appreciate that you're willing to share this part of your story with us because I know it's not easy. Your Aunt Franny, which was the family matriarch, you talked about her earlier, she married a man who became your uncle, and they even adopted one of your sisters. So tell us what happened with your uncle.
My life interspersed, I guess you could say, with trauma.
Mm-hmm.
Helped to form the person that I am today. And one of the things that that helped me to get to where I am today is, of course, being spiritually reborn, a Christian, and then therapy. Through therapy, I'm able to talk about the traumatic things that happened to me. I hope I can help somebody. One of the things that I want to say about that is that I haven't perpetuated any of the things that I've experienced.
Of course not. I hope that you're bringing some awareness to this because
yes.
Sometimes there's that stigma. And then people are afraid to speak out and share their story to help others because they're afraid that someone might look bad on them. And that's why it's so important, I think. And we're going to hear your story. But I also wanted to share that in the Native American community, sometimes there's an avoidance of therapy. We're strong. We're tough. We don't have to go to therapy. And especially as I've read, Native American men can especially feel that way. And I'm hoping that here you've got an elder here who has great experience in life, a warrior, a serviceman to our country, and he's able to tell his story and go to therapy and get the support he needs to work through it all over the years. I'm sure it hasn't been easy, but you make it look like it's not a weakness. It's a strength.
Mm-hmm.
So please continue.
Okay. It started when Aunt Fanny married a man who became my uncle. He was a World War II veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And so I learned about World War II from him and other men. And I was molested until I was about 10 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Going into his methods, enticing, promising this, that, to young boy.
What we now know as grooming. Right.
And then not only that, but molested others in my family, outside my family. Well,
wow.
But then the family circle, and I'm talking about, cousins, how many, I don't know, but I do know that he did do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was the first traumatic experience that that I went through, and there's all sorts of things that come with it that, you know, like the inner feelings that of being violated, and then the shame, you know, the shame of going through that, coming out of that at about 10 years old, and going into being a teen, and then experiencing the death of my mother at the age of 15. That was another traumatic experience, because you don't realize until someone is gone that, and it was like, you know, she was our, like you said, our rock.
She was your rock.
Yeah, and she was a very kind person. Getting back to the time I was 5 or 6 years old, we lived in a small house. My dad farmed. We had horses, cows, chickens, turkeys, hogs. My dad farmed. My grandfather owned a lot of land, and he gave my mother 25 acres. And so we farmed. My dad farmed at 25 acres plus a little bit of my grandfather's land. Then we lived right by the woods, Blackjack Hills. And then my mother, 1955, I believe it was, she got an oil lease. And we were like, I describe our family as the Indian Beverly Hillbillies. And so my mother got a lot of money for that time.
Yeah.
And bought a house. So we moved to... they moved the house and located it on the high hill, about a quarter mile from where our old house was at the edge of the woods. My dad quit farming. And then my mother, we bought a car. We got electricity. The only thing we didn't have was inside plumbing. The times were good. And then the last 3 or 4 years, my mother's money ran out from her oil lease. And then by then, about a couple of years, hard times, the company that leased our land drilled a gas well, it hit, and my mother was in the chips again.
Woo!
So that was in 1960, so times were good. I mean, she treated us good. We dressed well. We had all the toys of the day. We got different kind of model airplanes, model cars. We even got a skateboard.
Woo!
In the early 60s, we had a skateboard. No place to skate but in the house. But then my mother died in 63. She had a ruptured gallbladder. Back then, it was if it was ruptured, it was a literal death sentence. Because they didn't know how to treat it.
Yeah, you all went to the Holiness Church and followed the Oral Roberts teaching, and brimstone, Holy Ghost. And it didn't happen soon after that, a revival that was going on.
So, you know, we have, at the present day, we have our old religion. Our tribe had from way back when we were on the plains. We have the Taimé. Then we have the Tali. I call them the boy bones. Then we also have the Peyote religion. We still have that.
Mm-hmm.
So I was around mainly the Peyote religion when I was a little boy.
Yeah.
My aunt Fanny Howard, conducted Peyote meetings. So I seen how they set up inside the teepee, the moon, how they made the moon, and heard them sing, all that. When I was a little boy, I don't know, maybe about 5 years old or so, first church we used to attend was the a Methodist church that was baptized as a Methodist by Reverend Guy Wheaton back in the 50s. Then, maybe 1958, we start going to the Pentecostal church. It was an Indian Pentecostal church at Stecker.
Mm-hmm.
We attended that church until my mother died in 63. And one way I'm glad we attended the Pentecostal church, because that exposed me to the other Kiowa communities throughout Southwest Oklahoma. It was that time of spread of Pentecostal religion, Oral Roberts ministry mainly. There was a mobile ministry, I guess you could call it. And they would show films of the services, Oral Roberts services.
Yeah.
His healing ministry. And so, and with that, within the church, the hellfire and brimstone.
Right.
If you don't listen, if you don't accept the word of God, you're going to go to hell. Mm-hmm. And so
I remember that.
And it was revelations were taught, you know, revelations. You know, oh, it's going to be tough.
So at the time your mother passed away, how old were you?
I was 15 years old.
You were so young. Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. And your mama, who was born in 1916, sounded like a very special lady. And as I mentioned in the story in the beginning, she used to sing prayers in Kiowa to you, and she spoke Kiowa fluently. What else do you remember about her?
She's has a real old-time Kiowa face. The shape of her face, and then some of the older our chiefs from the 1800s, and she still had the strong features of
that's
the Kiowa.
Interesting, so, and especially of the chiefs.
So she was a Christian woman, mm-hmm. and she was humorous.
Oh, was she?
Yeah, she was humorous. Other people, she liked to joke, laugh, and she was generous.
Right.
She was generous to, how you say, a fault. And so, and I know that because when she got money, well, her folks, different folks would come around, her cousins, and, and some of her, you know, she needed work done on our house. And so she was generous. Well, of course, 1951, my brother Kenneth died, and she was heartbroken about that.
So sad.
What's it called? Encephalitis or something like that. Call it water on the brain.
Oh, man.
And he died in a sanatorium or something like that up there in Enid.
Okay.
That's where he died.
Right.
And he's buried over there at Ridstone. And then about 3 years later, or 4 years later, my grandfather, her dad, died, Grandpa Sam, 1955. Those are really hard times for her.
Mm-hmm.
So my parents didn't have a good relationship either. They separated, they came back, then they end up getting a divorce like in 1961. Thinking about it, I became independent. Maybe 6 months before my mother died, June of 63, they got to reconcile. Mm-hmm. When she died, there were six of us. September, right after school started, there was only two of us at home in Stecker, which was Tony, my little brother, and myself. And from that point on, we lived at home for the next 2 years alone.
And when you say alone, your dad actually left.
Yes.
He left you guys at home to live on your own.
Yes. Yep.
How did you do that?
Well, one thing is that he did come back every once in a while. Maybe I'll say once a month. He worked in construction. Lived in Lawton. And my little sister also moved to Lawton. And then my other sister got married and moved to Oklahoma City. He did come back every once in a while. We had chickens, so we had eggs. And then we had a line of credit down at the local grocery store at Tripp's Grocery.
So how did you get to the grocery?
Oh, we walked.
How far was it? Do you remember?
A mile and a half.
So you'd walk to get your groceries. You're such a positive person that you said it made me independent. It made me strong. But still, I mean, was it lonely?
The only lonely time that I remember was that day when we got a half a day off from school. Went to school and they let us off. My little brother and I, we went to Anadarko. And growing up and left to your own devices, you know, we like to go in out and we drank. Acquired alcohol, beer, hitting inhalants. We used all those from the time I was 15. We went out and we drank and partied around and for the afternoon and came back home. And, you know, we were always with the friends that had cars. And so back then, and right there where we grew up, country was, it was mm-hmm. roads weren't gravel, they were unpaved. And,
right. Just dirt.
Just basically. Dirt roads, and mm-hmm. there was a lot of sand. Our house was located on a hill, still is, old house still there, mm-hmm. about 150 yards off the road. So we're walking up to our front yard, and then that's when the sun was going down, and whippoorwill started sounding off into the woods, and then my little brother and I. I don't know, both of us must have the same thoughts, and it was so lonely. That was one of the most, and so at that time we looked at each other and we both started crying.
Your mom was probably looking at down from heaven trying to comfort you both.
I came from utter despair. And of course, I'll say this, I'm not the only one. There's others in rougher times than I experienced. We were fortunate in a lot of ways is that my mother left us land. So we had a place to stay. We still own our own land out there at the producing gas well. Mm-hmm. And I think it just being, within the last year, they shut that well down. Mm-hmm. And so it lasted from 1960, 61 up until 2023.
Wow.
And so that gave us a source of income. Getting back to my little brother and I were walking. We didn't have a car, so we would walk to the nearest highway, which was a mile away. There was a farm-to-market road from our little community of Stecker to north to Anadarko, and down it connected with Highway 9 down there, a place called Traders. And so we would walk across open field. There was gas wells on that property, so we'd walk up to open field and we'd walk down a gas well road and then to the highway. But I remember distinctly this thought came to me. We were walking. It was a fall time. It was cool. And I had this a vision in my mind that where I was at that time and where I wanted to be, and between myself and where I wanted to be was a gulf, just like a huge canyon, like the Grand Canyon. Mm-hmm. And then across that canyon was where I wanted to be. And then also going to I heard a car hidden north on that road. I envisioned a family being in that car, a mother and a father in the back seat, maybe about three children, and they're all happy.
Yeah.
Going to Anadarko, and that's what I wanted.
That's what you wanted.
Yeah. See, my brother, he was Charles, he was in the Marine Corps. You know, after Mama died, came back, he was late for a funeral. He sent us things. He cared for us. He still does. He sent money to get a suit.
So you graduated from high school.
In hindsight, there were more important things, little things that were more important to me than even family attending. I guess just graduating.
Which is a big deal, you know, like for you to have graduated knowing that your mom and dad were not in the house, and yet you still came to graduation, you finished high school.
Did a lot of positive things even during those times. Mm-hmm. I was a officer in our Future Farmers of America. I was for 3 years.
Wow.
A reporter, sentinel, and I was a president in my senior year. So despite not having anybody at home, my little brother and I, we went to school, and I'll say this, that noon meal at school was our main meal. When I graduated, I told my dad, you need to come back and live at home because the authorities are going to get Tony, my little brother.
Oh.
And they're going to send him to one of the state schools.
Right.
So he came back. And then I went off to college at Southwestern. I went for a year and a half. And then I wasn't a very good student. I was asked to leave. And I was got my draft notice. And I was scheduled to go in the Army August 22nd of 67. And instead, my older brother was a Marine. My little brother was a Marine. And I just couldn't envision myself being in the Army, my brothers being Marines. It was a warehouseman. I was assigned to a permanent duty at Camp Pendleton, Camp Las Flores, and then I got orders to join an infantry battalion after the Tet Offensive started in 1968. And February 17th, I joined the 27th Marine Regiment, 3rd Battalion, and I was put in a infantry battalion. So mm-hmm. I served 5 months in the infantry battalion at Vietnam, during the height of the Vietnam War. Spent 5 months in Vietnam, and then went back into supply, went to Okinawa, stationed in Okinawa, stationed at Camp Lejeune, and got out, and got out of the Marine Corps in 1970. Then 1985, when I think I was like 35 years old, I went in the reserves.
Okay.
And I was with the I was a member of Fox Battery, 2nd Battalion, 14th Marines in Oklahoma City. Got out of that in 89. And then I went into what's called Individual Ready Reserves. And into 1990 and 1991, I went on active duty during Desert Storm, Desert Shield. And I trained to be a tactics instructor at the Marine Corps School of Infantry during the Gulf War.
Okay, yeah.
So that ended my career in the Marine Corps.
Thank you for your service. And now you're even part of the Black Leggings Warrior Society.
This is, of course, an old antique Marine Corps emblem from back
Beautiful.
In the 30s. Nameplate. And then this is a tribute to the first Indian men to enlist in the United States Army of the 7th Cavalry. That was at Fort Sill. That's my tribute to them. And of course, these are the awards that awarded to my battalion. And then, of course, my patch of the 1st Marine Division.
Very nice.
And the reason I wear that 1st Marine Division patch is that was the division that my unit was attached to in wartime.
Very well deserved, though, those honors. And, you know, we talked earlier about the fact that there were the things that happened earlier in your life, the two major traumas, and trauma can be carried on, as we all know. And thankfully, you're able to go to the VA and talk through those to work through all of that.
Trauma, sexual abuse I had from the time I was 6 and 10 years old. Then the trauma of losing my mother at the age of 15. She got sick, and in a matter of a couple of days, she died. 3 years later, I went to the Marine Corps, and I experienced war. I was with the infantry, and the unit I was with, we suffered high casualties. Mm. I was there during the height of the Vietnam War.
Wow.
February, March, April, May, and June of 1968. Then I married, divorced twice. And both of those weren't pleasant things to go through because I didn't want those divorces, but it happened. Then later on, some of my family members were murdered. My sister, Rose, and then her daughter, my niece, Angela Biggers. And then 12 months later, my sister, Teresa, her grandson, DJ Davis, he was murdered. And then my little brother Tony, his son Dwayne, through some misfortune, he was suffering from PTSD, and the police were called to do a welfare check. He answered the door, and then he went out with the weapon, and he was shot by the police. And those are traumatic experiences.
Yes.
The main thing is that I was. Became a Christian. I was saved in a glorious way. Despite the trauma in my life, there's been a lot of positive things, good things. So I really, really believe, and I tell people this, that I really believe that our Creator, God, Jesus Christ, will bless us. He'll bless
yes.
us, whether it's either here on this earth or in the world to come.
Amen. That's a beautiful tribute to the journey you've been on. And my sister always says, trust the journey. And I truly believe that. And you are here today as a miracle and as a survivor and a thriver. And I hope that other, not just Native Americans, but people will look at your story and go, if he can do it, I can do it. I think about the two boys who were left on their own to take care of and raise themselves in the house at the end of the long country road. It seems unfair that any young person should have to feel that sense of abandonment and loneliness. And did God forget about them? I like to think that God was maybe reminding Blossom, his brother, of his love through the songs of the Whippoorwills. Either way, May Bloss's story inspire you to have hope, endurance, and faith no matter what the situation. May he bless you and protect you, my friend, Yakoki Bloss.
Thanks for listening to Native Chalk Talk. Be sure to join our community on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And check us out at nativechalktalk.com. Stay tuned for the next episode. You're going to love it. Yakoki. Thank you, my friends.